maybe 30 or 20 years ago, a Saudi might have said, I'm Muslim and I'm Arab and I'm Saudi. Now they might say, I'm Saudi and I'm Arab and I'm Muslim.
You know, they're trying to radically refashion their country and they need help from the best experts in the world. Do you want to have your country's people be disqualified from that because of some essentially antiquated point of view about how countries work together?
In recent months, it can feel like Saudi Arabia is intent on buying the world. It's bought up much of golf, sports teams, many of the globe's best soccer players to its own domestic league, and it owns huge chunks of many of the biggest companies on the planet. But Saudi Arabia is not just on a shopping spree. The once insular, oil-rich kingdom is transforming into a major diplomatic and military player, a pivotal actor in the energy transition, and looks set to host high-end cultural events like the FIFA World Cup.
You know, they know that buying a football club immediately brings you a billboard into a global game that allows you to completely reposition yourself and rebrand yourself.
It feels like we're entering the era of the Saudi project. But what exactly is the kingdom trying to achieve, and will it succeed? Coming soon from Intelligence Squared, The Saudi Project is a new podcast series seeking to answer some of these questions and more.
Britain does have choices. It's not either-or situation. We either indulge Mohammed bin Salman or boycott Mohammed bin Salman. There is a third choice.
Search The Saudi Project wherever you get your podcasts.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm senior producer Connor Boyle. Today we're continuing our discussion with world and religious leaders who gathered in London in 2012 for an Intelligence Squared event in collaboration with the Elders Organization. Joining broadcaster Jon Snow on stage were former US President Jimmy Carter, Mary Robinson, the first female president of Ireland and former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the South African religious leader and activist. The second part of this wide-ranging discussion sees the distinguished panel reflecting on topics such as the ethics of drone warfare, human rights in the digital age, and the future of NATO. If you'd like to hear this episode ad-free and support our mission to foster honest debate and compelling conversations, head over to intelligencesquared.com/membership or subscribe to our channel on Apple. Now let's jump back into the conversation. We return with Mary Robinson commenting on reproductive rights for women and how that plays into issues of global sustainability.
But I think what a number of us found very worrying in Rio, including Gru and myself, was the fact that in a discussion about sustainable development, the initial text had rightly emphasis on the importance of reproductive health and rights was removed, which was backsliding on both the Cairo conference in 1994 and the Beijing conference on
women.
Could
you detect the origin of the removal?
Yes, there were a few countries, Costa Rica, the European Union didn't come out very strongly, particularly because of Malta. Nobody understood.
Malta wagged Europe's tail?
Malta wagged Europe's tail on this issue. And I think there were probably a few other countries that weren't pushing it either. But the point really is that for women's groups who've been following this, and language matters very much in this context, it was a step back. Rio was a step back on the World Conference Against Women for Women in Beijing.
Before we open it up to the audience, which we're going to do momentarily, as I think would be said in your country, before we open it up momentarily to the audience, I want to come to one last and I would have thought very present issue, and that is the technology and war, and the extent to which the human is being removed from the battlefield to originate assassination and killing from a very distant place on a computer screen. Is there anything morally, do you think, different between presence on the battlefield and pushing a button 5,000 miles away in the sanctity of some northern state? Morally.
Not for me.
It's all war.
Yes. I mean, I think to use technology in the fashion that they do...
Drones don't worry you.
I'm absolutely appalled, you know, we're so casual. You know, when you think, I mean, that they can pinpoint and assassinate someone, and sometimes it's innocent children, women, old people who become the victims of this, and sort of clinically. For me, it's actually worse. I mean, it makes it worse that we can use an extraordinary gift that God has given us of intelligence for this, when we could be wanting to use it for things like helping to produce food, helping people to have clean water.
Or using the same technology to bombard a cancerous cell.
Absolutely.
President Carter.
Well, I think when you depersonalize war on one side of the battle, for instance, if a major country can destroy another region from 30,000 feet bombing, where there's no involvement personally of the nation itself or even the pilot other than releasing the bombs, with no danger to himself, then the only people who suffer are the ones who are the recipients of the attack. And the same thing happens when you, by remote control, kill people with a drone. So I think that the major deterrent to war in the past has been that both sides suffer. Mm. So that if somebody's going to attack others, they realize I might be involved myself. I might have my own child killed. And when you move that deterrent, you not only depersonalize the combat and remove a deterrent to it, but you also reduce the recipients of the attack to subhumanity, as though they are not equal to you in the eyes of God, in the eyes of human beings, in the eyes of the international community. So I think that it's a very serious step that we have taken from massive aerial bombing all the way through to the drone attack.
As you're the only American president in the last 50 years not to have fired a shot in anger in the course of his presidency, or not had his country fire a shot in anger, it's no good my asking you whether as president you would have ever used a drone.
That's a hard thing to answer, but my external opinion of what I would have done is that I would not. I would not.
But your internal opinion is...
Well, you know, I don't know what circumstances would have happened when I was president. That's hard to say. But we worship the Prince of Peace. And I think one of the major elements of human life should be to do everything you can to promote peace and deter war. So I think human rights and peace cover the basic thrust of what the elders are about. And I don't think in any of our discussions in the last 5 years we have ever departed from that basic principle that the elders, no matter what else happens, in every way we can, sometimes very minimal ways, sometimes a maximum influence, we're going to promote peace and we're going to promote human rights.
Of course, that is a fundamental advantage when you land at... In Sudan, in Khartoum,
yes.
The one thing they can be absolutely certain of is A, you won't be carrying a Kalashnikov, and B, you won't have access to a nuclear bomb.
That's correct.
Or any form of weapon.
And you know, I think the entire concept of human rights includes peace, justice, and so forth.
Mary?
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, I agree very much with that. In fact, I was very glad that one of the first initiatives of the elders was during the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration. We had a whole year of encouraging the marking of that Universal Declaration with a whole lot of organisations, Amnesty, etc., every human has rights. But the point that you triggered in my mind is I remember as High Commissioner for Human Rights, I was very concerned about the refugees from Kosovo. And with a number of my colleagues, I was visiting. And then I went into Serbia I didn't meet Milosevic. He refused to meet me. I met the foreign minister. And then we were taken under escort of the Serbian authorities to the town of Niš, because the mayor of that town had been very much a human rights person. We wanted to get more information from him, and we were building a case for the International Criminal Court. And we were stopped because there was bombing ahead of us. And I thought, oh, we'll have to go all the way back to Belgrade now. And they said, no, no, come quickly. And we came to a poor housing estate on the outskirts of Niš where there had been bombing by NATO. And there were cluster bombs on all kinds of levels that children would have been playing. And there were, a few people were injured. I don't think anybody was killed. And I reported on that and criticised NATO. And I got heavily censored. You know, the idea of an official of the United Nations criticising NATO. And yet, I saw with my own eyes. And, you know, women and children are not collateral damage. I think now with drones and with the technology, as you said, it's more worrying. And it's more worrying in lots of other ways, too. Invasion of privacy, the use of internet. We are actually, as elders, taking it upon ourselves to look at the internet and privacy issues and human rights. And we're not going to be the technical experts. But we are going to keep reminding our world that we do have common values of human rights and of commitment to peace.
Well, at that point, we're going to throw up some light because there are some microphones up in the gods, up here and down here somewhere. Tell us who you are and off we go.
Good evening. I'm very pleased to be here and want to say hello to Mary Robinson, who I used to work for briefly. Hearing you speak about a range of issues, I'm curious if, as the elders, you see common barriers to progress among the different issues, whether it be peace, whether it be sustainable development. For example, I heard Joe Stiglitz the other night talking about how our cognitive frameworks aren't changing fast enough to help us address these issues. So I wanted to ask your opinions. Thank you.
Mary, she's yours. You start.
I didn't arrange this. I think what the question was whether there are common threads of common barriers in the various issues that we address, and whether, you know, and in a way, I think we're in a period of change that we don't fully appreciate. Political change, the power in our world is changing with the emerging economies and the shifts that are taking place. We have this urgent need to safeguard our world by having sustainable development and by caring enough about the global warming that could destroy our whole ecosystem of the world. We have a financial system that's broken and is causing huge issues of divisiveness, and we certainly don't have the leadership at the moment on those at the political level. In fact, we seem to have less leadership. It's almost, I think it's, issues have become very complicated, and political leaders are only looking 6 months ahead or 4 or 5 years ahead, and many of the things we need to talk about are intergenerational. We need the kind of reform, the more egalitarian society, that, you know, to me is essential, and really addressing poverty and
I think it would be right to say that there's nobody who comes from any country assembled in this room who wouldn't agree with that. I mean, that besets all of us in every developed country. I'm less aware of the South, but that rings real bells.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Let's take as many questions as we can. In the tie at the top there.
Nick Kenyon.
It's Sir Nicholas Kenyon who runs this place.
Here we are in an arts centre. In terms of what you were saying about the search for peace, Do you see a role for the arts in releasing creativity and actually helping conflict resolution?
And the last one up here.
I had a question for President Carter, which was, did you find you had more impact and power when you were in presidency or now as part of the elders, and why?
It's such a good question, we'll get it out now.
Well,
did you have more impact and power as a president or now?
I really had more impact and power as president, although it was not nearly as enjoyable. And the best part of my life has been the last 30 years, particularly since I've been involved with the elders, because I work with other people, and we are more directly involved with individual people who are suffering in the world. But I would never have been able to bring about a peace treaty between Israel and Egypt as an elder. But I could use the full power and political influence of my own country to help to force the two leaders to come together. And that treaty has lasted now for almost 35 years. So there are a few things I could have done as president, like normalize relations with China, that I couldn't do as president. But I think that that's a very good question. And as far as power is concerned, president would be more effective. As far as influence is concerned, I think the collective elders can be more of an influence for peace and human rights than I could be as president.
Can you see a role for the arts in conflict resolution? Can you see them playing a role that in some way opens opportunities?
Speaking from my own experience at home, I mean, when we were struggling against apartheid, oh, absolutely, certainly. I mean, the arts were quite critical. I mean, you had people who could criticize the apartheid system quite trenchantly, but because they were on the stage and the South African government was trying to make out that they were Western, that kind of criticism was something that could happen. And I mean, we were particularly energized by song as well. I mean, you know, that singing when you were hurting, say at funerals, and when you were celebrating. And I think, I mean, yeah.
What about Baron Boehm's Palestinian-Israeli orchestra?
Absolutely.
The East-West Levant, or it's called. Probably had it playing here, Nick, without a doubt.
The other thing would be when you stop people going to places that are troublesome.
By what means?
Did you... I'm speaking English.
Are you talking about sporting fixtures?
Yes. No.
Sporting fixtures.
No. Boycotts.
Boycotts.
Yes. I mean, it's quite important when you have people who are celebrities in the arts saying, "No, we are not going to go to South Africa. We are not going to go over there." That's it seemed a negative, but it isn't. I mean, people feel those things often more sharply.
Ma'am.
As the women's rights advocate for Human Rights Watch, I definitely need your advice. What do we do when an issue that we know is crucial to women's rights, to women's dignity, to the future of the planet, such as reproductive health, is so stuck that we cannot move forward? How do you think we can push such an issue forward? What are some of the foolproof methods that you know exist that we can use for this kind of issue?
I think it's important that this issue is seen as mainstream to development. And that's a message that we tried to put across, both Gro Brundtland and myself, very strongly in Rio. I also happen to chair a Global Leaders Council on Reproductive Health, which includes Fernando Henrique Cardoso, and also Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the president of Liberia, and Joyce Banda, the president of Malawi, and a number of others who see the need to sort of champion it visibly and with conviction in order that it isn't a taboo subject or a stigmatized subject. But the most important thing, I think, is to keep affirming the central role of sexual and reproductive health for girls, for women, and that also it's relevant to an issue that now comes up more and more. I have a foundation on climate justice. I talk a lot about it, and I get the question, what about population control? And I have to answer as gently as I can and say, that's an important issue, but the wrong question. It's not what about population control? We know what to do, and it doesn't come from the outside as a kind of control. It's educating of girls and women, having health systems that bring down maternal and child deaths, and having reproductive health as part of the education of girls and women, and of men and boys, for that matter.
I want you to talk about women.
You want to talk about women.
It seems a little facetious, but it isn't. I am actually quite serious. When my own particular theory is most women would be people who bring to life and nurture, and that when they are truly feminine, they are hardly likely to be warmongers. That a woman who's carried a baby for 9 months in a womb is not likely to want to see the child being cannon fodder. And quite seriously, I have suggested that we did, in fact, want a revolution, that women ought to be saying to us men, we have allowed you. The world is in a mess. Just get out of the way. And unfortunately, people think, that one is not being serious. But when you think, how did peace come in Liberia? Peace came because women of the different faiths came together and said, we are going to pray the devil back to hell. Mm-hmm. And it was largely because of the role that women played, that peace came. I'm going to shut up.
No, it's a good thought to leave ringing in our ears.
I'm going
the
to
Liberian
leave it.
Experience. Yes, it's yes, a good thing to yes, leave in our ears for this moment. Yes, I want to move you on to one more thing.
Yes, all right.
And that is the very good question about Sri Lanka and human rights and how people are allowed to say, well, it's just a Western sort of... Well, infliction.
Yeah, in fairness, the Human Rights Council did pass that important resolution about Sri Lanka, and the elders were very strongly supportive, and we had an op-ed about it, and it was very important. Now we have to follow up on that, and the Office of High Commissioner for Human Rights must, address the way in which Sri Lanka responds to that resolution, and so there is a... it's not the strongest process, but there is a process there, which is important. There's also the Universal Periodic Review, which Sri Lanka will come before the Council for this year. And I think it's on the record, and it has been a very important statement by the Human Rights Council that is at least saying Sri Lanka must implement their own report. And must go further and must have prosecute those who have been responsible for the worst cases. And they have been terrible cases of violations of human rights of the civilian population.
Right, let's take... everybody's at the microphone. I'll take you two first.
Yeah, hi. My question would be for President Carter. You have underlined the sacrosanctity of the elections and how we should, in fact, in the case of Egypt, and how we should, in fact, not only acknowledge it, but support it very rightfully. And my question is, how would you reconcile this concept, very important pillar concept, with the results in Aceh, which you, I'm sure you're familiar, is this region in Indonesia where, through democratically elected government, and one that has been actually re-elected a couple of months ago, Sharia has been implemented and very forcefully applied.
That was in Niger, did you say?
Aceh.
In?
In Indonesia.
Indonesia,
sorry.
In Aceh.
Yeah. In Aceh, yeah.
Worth for a journalist to know that fact.
Thank you. No, sorry. I couldn't hear through the echo.
Sorry.
Thanks very much. And the next question?
Thanks. I've had the opportunities to see the elders in action in Rio, in Copenhagen, in many places, and I'd like to thank them for the inspiration they bring to grassroots activists and younger people. However, I want to raise a somewhat controversial issue. Do you think that it's important now for the elders to add the voice to attacking and interrogating the quality of democracy that we actually have in the world? Because very many of the countries that claim to be promoters of democracy are actually far too often the underminers of democracy. The United States today, I would say, is the best democracy money can buy. And the example that John Snow gave about the bankers here in the UK who can engage in billions of dollars of theft and can walk away with bonuses when people, to use Jimmy Carter's example, with a joint in their pocket, have to spend time in prison. So should the elders moving forward not begin to actually begin to add some qualitative discussion to what is democracy in the current world that we live in? Thank you.
Excellent question. Thank you very much. You five up there.
Hi. We've heard a lot about women's rights, which is obviously a big issue, but nothing about queer rights. And I was wondering, with such a diverse group of elders, including such religious people, whether LGBTQ plus groups were on your agenda?
Gay rights. Did you say gay rights?
Gay rights.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Yep. And
a question for Archbishop Joseph Duncan, Tutu Foundation. Question about Ubuntu. I've personally been immensely inspired by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the idea of, you know, one family and, you know, that everybody else's brother and sister. But, you know, the culture that I find myself living in just seems to be so, you know, pushing me and everybody else towards, you know, punitive, punishing people and splitting people up and putting people into boxes. And, you know, wanting to promote, you know, the ideas of Ubuntu or community togetherness, it's like, where do we start with culture? You know, where does oppression need to be? And what can we do as, you know, individual citizens, you know, really, to really shift this? What's it going to take?
Excellent. And the final one up that.
I run a project called Think at Vote, where we ask people from all backgrounds what the future they choose is for the world and how we can create it. I was wondering what an act is from each of you of something that we can do as individuals to create the world that we've been talking about tonight.
Very good. Do you think it's time that the elders began to interrogate the quality of democracy? You've appreciated democracy winning in Egypt. But our questioner suggested there's a lot of people say they're running a wonderfully democratic situation. And as he put it, the United States has the best democracy money can buy. Should the elders be looking at the quality of democracy and interrogating it a little, given that it is such a yardstick by which you make judgments?
Well, he also mentioned Indonesia. I was there personally when Indonesia had their first democratic election in almost 50 years, following two dictators, and it was an honest and fair election. And we went back 5 years later for another honest and fair election where the people's voices were heard. And now they have a democracy there that I think is going to be stable. And within that democracy, in Aceh and other places, there are problems still existing. But I think that their democracy is good. And I think in Egypt, Although we may not like the outcome of the election, this was the expression of the majority of people who went to the polls and voted. And I think that we certainly can look at the quality of democracy. In the United States, with a stupid decision recently made by the Supreme Court that corporations can give unlimited amounts of money, I think it has subverted the basic integrity of our electoral system in America.
If you distill that statement, that one sentence, it's probably one of the most powerful statements a former United States president has ever made. That is, to call the Supreme Court decision stupid, it was stupid indeed, but to hear it from you is
well, maybe other people could think of a better way to describe it, but that's my best word that I can think of. Because it has subverted the American system, and it's made that enormous amount of money coming in be spent almost entirely on negative advertising. Where to win an election now, you destroy the reputation and integrity of your opponent. And that negative attitude has divided our people into two opposing and irreconcilable positions in the Congress and other places. So I think basically democracy is by far the best system of government. Because not only if you make a mistake at the beginning, like they may have made in Egypt or we may have made in the United States, it's self-corrective ultimately. If the people can have a right to say, okay, we made a mistake, let's correct it in the next election, that's the integrity of democracy. So I'm completely convinced that when the people express their will, those who go to the polls and vote and choose a leader, the world ought to recognize that leader chosen by the people as legitimate and ought to cooperate and try to make that leader be successful.
Do you believe that changing laws can often be more effective than talking to a whole lot of leaders? Do you have a message for the next generation? And finally, and you can choose any one of these or perm one of three, message for the next generation, the role of law.
If I can just answer the other question, what we can all do, and I think Archie already said this, I think we do believe as elders that everybody can make a difference and that the world needs people to think in terms of I can make a difference. And it's back to maybe thinking more actively about what it is to be a citizen, back to Kumi's question about democracy. What I will take away from this evening's discussion and what we've heard from the floor is that we need to be thinking more about how we live as good citizens in the 21st century and what we demand of governments. And there shouldn't be double standards, there shouldn't be the corruption of money. And above all, as you say, hopefully we will get an arms trade treaty at the end of July, at the end of this month, in fact. Oxfam and others are working very hard on that. And that would be the beginning of sanity when it comes to armaments, which are out of control.
I missed one question from your domain, from everybody's domain. Gay rights.
Yes. Well, nobody's been more outspoken on gay rights in African countries than you, Arch.
Yes, I. At the moment, I am sad that in our church or our communion, the Anglican communion, at a time when there is so much poverty and conflict and disease. What are we spending time on? Spending time on is this okay? I mean, is this kosher or halal for this person to love that person? And as we're coming from where I come, where I was penalized for something about which I could do nothing, my ethnicity, I couldn't possibly keep quiet when people are being persecuted for something about which they can do nothing, basically, their sexual orientation. And I couldn't, I mean, I can't understand, just as a matter of justice. How can we want to clobber somebody? We say, well, racism is is evil and all of that. I think homophobia is too.
And your message to the next generation?
Well, I would hope to imitate or to repeat what Archbishop said a few minutes ago. God knows that the future of the world depends on the young people retaining their idealism and their moral values, their hopes and their dreams. And if they don't do it, if they submerge themselves into being affected by the mundane aspects of life, how much can I get at the expense of others and so forth, we won't succeed. But I have confidence, optimism, that in the future we'll see a world of peace and human rights. So that's where you come. But how to affect the lawmakers, that is a big problem that we have to address. We'll do our share as 10 elders, but the vast majority of people in this audience are the ones that are going to shape the future in my country, in Great Britain, in Europe, in Africa, in Asia, all over the world.
My friends, we have been in on an intoxicating moment in history. Three wonderful minds have been gathered before us, taking our questions and exploring the issues of our day. And they've left us with one message that we should each take out of this room. I can make a difference. And if each of us takes that away, we will leave this room collectively more powerful than we entered it. So I'd like on your behalf to thank President Jimmy Carter, former President Mary Robinson, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Very well done.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. The episode was produced by Hannah Kay with editing from Tom Hall. We'd love to hear your feedback and what you think we should be talking about next. Send us an email or a voice note with your thoughts to podcasts@intelligencesquared.com. And if you'd like to hear more, attend some of our live events, or peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds, then head over to intelligencesquared.com.